Good evening, everyone. We're going to start off this evening with some quotations from tablets and talks of Abdu'l-Bahá, and also some extracts from Baha'u'lláh as well. On the subject of the evanescence of this world, and also something of the way this world relates to the other world, hierarchically, how things come to be in this world from that world. Please feel free to indicate if you have some comment or question. We'll stop along the way as well. But first, I think we should drink in, imbibe some of these texts to set us in the mood for this discussion. The Master says, "Grieve thou not over the troubles and hardships of this nether world, nor be thou glad in times of ease and comfort, for both shall pass away. This present life is even as a swelling wave, or a mirage, or drifting shadows. Could ever a distorted image on the desert serve as refreshing waters? No, by the Lord of Lords. Never can reality and the mere semblance of reality be one, and wide is the difference between fancy and fact, between truth and the phantom thereof. Know thou that the kingdom is the real world, and this nether place is only its shadow stretching out. A shadow hath no life of its own. Its existence is only a fantasy and nothing more. It is but images reflected in water and seeming as pictures to the eye." Well, that takes care of this world, doesn't it? In another tablet, the Master says, "Know thou that this nether world is the mirror of the kingdom, and the former is exactly the counterpart of the latter." In other words, this world is the counterpart of the kingdom. "The sound opinions of the world, which are the results of philosophical right thinking, correspond to the traces of the kingdom, or the signs of the kingdom. There does not exist any difference whatever between them, for the reality of things is hidden in the treasuries of the kingdom, and as soon as this reality is bodied forth upon this plane of the nether world, the symbols and realities of the contingent beings become apparent." "The world spiritual is like unto the world phenomenal. They are the exact counterpart of each other. Whatever objects appear in this world of existence are the outer pictures of the world of heaven, or, as he said in the early ones, are the reflections or the shadows of the world of the kingdom. And again, the worlds of God are in perfect harmony and correspondence one with another. Each world in this limitless universe is, as it were, a mirror reflecting the history and nature of all the rest. The physical universe is likewise in perfect correspondence with the spiritual or divine realm. The world of matter is an outer expression or facsimile of the inner kingdom of the spirit. The world of mind corresponds with the world of hearts." That's from Promulgation, page 264. Again, he says, "The world and its objects are transitory. Phenomena undergo change and transformation, but God and his servants remain unalterable and not subject to transmutation. We must attach our hearts to him if we desire to be eternally happy." Likewise, he says, "I hope that in this nether world thou shalt attain unto heavenly light. Thou wilt free the souls from the gloom of nature, which is the animal kingdom, and cause them to reach lofty stations in the human kingdom. Today all people are immersed in the world of nature. That is why thou dost see jealousy, greed, the struggle for survival. Deception, hypocrisy, tyranny, oppression, disputes, strife, bloodshed, looting and pillaging, which all emanate from the world of nature. Few are those who have been freed from this darkness, who have ascended from the world of nature to the world of man, who have followed the divine teachings, have served the world of humanity, are resplendent, merciful, illumined, and like unto a rose garden. Strive thine utmost to become godlike, characterized with his attributes, illumined and merciful, that thou mayest be freed from every bond and become attached at heart to the kingdom of the incomparable Lord. This is Baha'i bounty. This is heavenly light. We get a very distinct impression from these few extracts from the tablets of Abdu'l-Bahá of the relative value between the kingdom and this world. Now, you'll recall from the earlier discussions and readings that we've had that the kingdom is very real in this world, in the hearts of God's servants, in the hearts of his lovers. That's the place where it lives. The last one is from Selections from the Writings of Abdu'l-Bahá, page 206. And he explains how the world of nature, or even the outer world of existence, is really evanescent and shadowy and not firm in the sense that we like to think of it when it's compared with the spiritual world. Now, mostly we have the idea from our Western inheritance, those of us that have a Western inheritance, that this is the solid real world, you know, and the world of the spirit or kingdom is a kind of, who knows, not a very firm thing anyway. I mean, you know, you got to deal with reality first and then figure out the rest of it afterwards. Now, Abdu'l-Bahá is telling us over and over again that it's just the opposite, that's the real world, and that this is a consequence of that world. This is an outworking of certain realities and principles that are there. It's like reflections in a mirror. It's like images reflected on water. It's vague, it's evanescent. In another place he calls it the dust heap of a mortal world. It's like mirage in the desert. It's not real. Not something substantial to which one should attach their attention and their hearts. This is, of course, he wants to tell us, to attach yourself to the kingdom and its qualities. Then one has this cutting detachment, or cutting oneself off from the world. That is, that its influence you should free yourself from it, and you should become wholly spiritual. That the spiritual power should take possession of your being. In other words, the high-minded attributes and virtues that we think of as characterizing the human state. And that once that happens, then one finds that the world and its things become tools for the right expression of service. And then all things are permitted unto the soul, in the sense of wealth is something that becomes necessary. Abdu'l-Bahá says that when the soul reaches spiritual maturity, means are necessary. It should acquire wealth so that it can perform philanthropic acts, so that it can assist with its spiritual understanding the development of society. So it isn't as if we don't look to wealth and gold for any purposes at all, but we shouldn't be attached to it. We should be the same with it or without it. If we attain to the condition where that's the case, then if it comes to us, we'll use it properly. We'll use it in serving God. We'll recognize that it comes from him, and all things belong unto him anyway. and will know how to deal with it. Baha'u'llah has set the initial understanding of this in his tablets, in his time, and one of them is cited in the Gleanings, page 100. He says, "It behooveth the people of Baha to die to the world and all that is therein, to be so detached from all earthly things that the inmates of paradise may inhale from their garment the sweet-smelling savor of sanctity, that all the peoples of the earth may recognize in their faces the brightness of the All-Merciful, and that through them may be spread abroad the signs and tokens of God, the Almighty, the All-Wise." Now there's more to that passage. You may wish to look it up. It's on page 100. This recalls also one of the hidden words from the Arabic, number 54. "O son of being, if thine heart be set upon this eternal, imperishable dominion and this ancient, everlasting life, forsake this mortal and fleeting sovereignty." The Bab is even stronger. In his words, he says, "This mortal life is like unto the carcass of a dog, around which none would gather, nor would any partake thereof, except those who gainsay the life hereafter," who deny the afterlife. Some selections from the writings of the Bab, page 19. Then he has this to say for the world: "Fie upon the world and its people, and upon those who take delight in earthly riches, while oblivious of the life to come." Now notice how he connects so clearly hereafter, the hereafter, and the life to come in these passages, because they don't mix together. If your attention is on the kingdom or the life to come, the life to come in that sense is also the spiritual life of this present phase of existence, if you will, but it should be well established in one, so that the changes and chances of the world don't affect the condition of the soul. Remember in the I think it's in the Four Valleys, isn't it, about the companions of the cave, and they're in there, and the sun rises and the sun sets and all kinds of mercantile operations and things are going on, but they're not moved by these things. They're within the refuge of detachment from the world. Again, he says, "In the estimation of them that have fixed their eyes upon the merciful Lord, the riches of the world and its trappings are worth as much as the eye of a dead body, nay, even less." And I have this quote here again. We've had it before, but it's interesting to bear in mind in this respect too. "It is better to guide one soul than to possess all that is on earth. For as long as that guided soul is under the shadow of the tree of divine unity, he and the one who hath guided him will both be recipients of God's tender mercy. Whereas possession of earthly things will cease at the time of death." So if we want to store up treasures, we have to store up spiritual treasures, the treasures of having assisted with the illumination of other souls, having shared the water of life with other friends, other human beings, and having them become quickened through them. That's a real treasure for the soul. Again, the master in selections from the writings of Abdu'l-Bahá, page 175, addresses us. He says, "O ye sons and daughters of the kingdom, thankful the birds of the spirit seek only to fly in the high heavens and to sing out their songs with wondrous art. But the pitiable earthworms love only to tunnel into the ground. And what a mighty struggle they make to get themselves down into its depths. Even so are the sons of earth. Their highest aim is to augment their means of continuing on in this vanishing world, this death in life. And this despite the fact that they are bound hand and foot by 1,000 cares and sorrows." Thank and never safe from danger, not even for the twinkling of an eye, never at any time secure, even from sudden death. Wherefore, after a brief span, are they utterly effaced, and no sign remaineth to tell of them, and no word of them is ever heard again. Then let you engage in the praise of Baha'u'llah, for it is through his grace and succor that ye have become sons and daughters of the kingdom. It is thanks to him that ye are now songsters in the meadows of truth and have soared upward to the heights of the glory that abideth forever. Ye have found your place in the world that dieth not. The breaths of the Holy Spirit have blown upon you. Ye have taken on another life. Ye have gained access to the threshold of God. He addresses us again. He says, O ye loved ones of God, know ye that the world is even as a mirage rising over the sands, that the thirsty mistaketh for water. The wine of this world is but a vapor in the desert, its pity and compassion but toil and trouble. The repose it proffereth only weariness and sorrow. Abandon it to those who belong to it, and turn your faces unto the kingdom of your Lord, the All-Merciful, that his grace and bounty may cast their dawning splendors over you, and a heavenly table may be sent down for you, and your Lord may bless you and shower his riches upon you to gladden your bosoms and fill your hearts with bliss, to attract your minds and cleanse your souls and console your eyes. If we're still not convinced, he goes on, he says, such is this mortal abode, a storehouse of afflictions and suffering. It is ignorance that binds man to it, for no comfort can be secured by any soul in this world. From monarch down to the most humble commoner, if once this life should offer a man a sweet cup, 100 bitter ones will follow. Such is the condition of this world. The wise man, therefore, doth not attach himself to this world or to this mortal life, and doth not depend upon it. At some moments even he eagerly wisheth for death, that he may thereby be freed from these sorrows and afflictions. Mortal charm shall pass away, shall fade away. Roses shall give way to thorns, and beauty and youth shall live their day and be no more. But that which eternally endureth is the beauty of the True One, for its splendor perisheth not, and its glory lasteth forever. Its charm is all-powerful, and its attraction infinite. Well is it then with that countenance that reflecteth the splendor of the light of the Beloved One. Once the Master was asked about reincarnation. Someone wanted to know, it said, how could it be fair and just that I should live so long in this world and not have the best things, you know, that others have had? And surely there must be another life where this justice works itself out. And the Master said that no merciful God would make a soul pass twice through this world. So as much as to say, well, this is justice, also his mercy is in play here. He's not going to send anybody back here twice. And then he explains how, again, as he says here, from king to pauper, everybody suffers here. There's nobody escapes from the world's afflictions. Just because people have riches, in fact, you may know people who have a lot of wealth, how they suffer with the problems that afflict them, how really they're burdened down more with the weight of their finances than those that are free of them. If you've, any of you have lived in rainforests or traveled among indigenous people where money is not even a question, it's a barter with a little bit of food products or something. People live so detached Now, there are people who in those circumstances are also miserly and attached also, but you can see how little the world can live with and how it can free itself from complications. Oftentimes in such places, such remote places, you find that breathing the life of the faith, speaking about the faith, produces dreams in the hearts and minds of the people. Before you get there, when you start saying prayers for the area, that starts happening. When the Baha'is visit there, you find them saying they've had dreams, they've seen the Master, or they'll ask, you'll show them a picture of the Master, and they'll say, oh, I seen him, he came when I chopped my foot that time and told me it would be all right, or something. Such thing as it. Still, to reinforce the same thing, I'm sure there's hundreds of tablets on this subject. O thou who art attracted to the kingdom of God, every soul seeketh an object and cherisheth a desire, and day and night striveth to attain his aim. One craveth riches, another thirsteth for glory, and still another yearneth for fame, for art, for prosperity and the like. Yet finally, all are doomed to loss and disappointment. One and all, they leave behind them all that is theirs, and empty-handed hasten to the realm beyond. And all their labors shall be in vain. To dust they shall all return, denuded, depressed, disheartened, and in utter despair. But praised be the Lord, thou art engaged in that which secureth for thee a gain that shall eternally endure. And that is naught but thine attraction to the kingdom of God, thy faith and thy knowledge, the enlightenment of thine heart, and thine earnest endeavor to promote the divine teachings. Verily, this gift is imperishable, and this wealth is a treasure from on high. Now, to distinct degrees, we are all partaking of these riches. We're giving of our time and our life, our energies to serve here at the World Center. We have made a decision. We have given up things for the cause. We have sacrificed other ambitions and gains that we might have acquired. And we have weighed this in the balance and decided that this service here was something that we wanted to do. And we can't doubt that that's but pleasing to God. The life of man in this world is short and will soon draw to an end. Consequently, one must appreciate every moment of his life, exerting himself in that which is conducive to eternal glory. O thou spiritual friend, now the Master is addressing a spiritual friend. He says, this world is a prison for the heavenly souls, and this earthly world is but a cage and not a nest unto the divine birds. A prisoner who is awake and conscious will certainly seek for freedom, and a mindful bird will certainly wish for deliverance from the cage. The life of man in this world is short and will soon draw to an end. Consequently, one must appreciate or count as gain every moment, every breath or moment of his life. This is in a tablet of Abdu'l-Bahá. This is one of the early tablets that in Abdu'l-Bahá's ministry Shoghi Effendi translated to English. He says, no matter how strenuously man may strive in this world, ultimately no result will be attained. Naked has he stepped into this world, and naked shall he get out of it, except if he turns unto God, supplicates to his kingdom, strives in his path, serves the Almighty, and acquires a pure heart, a seeing eye, a responsive ear, and a spirit that is gladdened by the glad tidings of God. This has a result and gives forth fruit. Otherwise, man shall not gather any advantage from life. The days of human existence are like vanishing shadows. Compared to the world of reality, they are brought to a close with extreme speed. And amongst the world of humanity, those who lead a heedless life are afflicted with manifest loss, for when the days of their life come to a sudden end, there is no trace, no leaves, no blossom, no fruit. They shall remain in the lowest degree, and no mention is left behind for them. From king to servant, all walk this fleeting path and live in this circle, but none shall endure save those who are freed from every tie. Master speaks to us, addresses us in such a way that we want to cut ourselves from the world. And he clarifies the dimension of it all in these things. And the reading of these and meditating on them is the means of removing these ties. The means of first discovering that they're there, meditating on what their possible outcome could be, what their value might be, and then working at severing ourselves, which I always like to think of in the opposite of in trying to get away from the world by just becoming more interested in drawing close to the kingdom, because the world is here and at the opposite end of the pole is the kingdom. So the farther you move away from the world simply means that it's the more you're attracted to the spiritual world, the spiritual kingdom. That's the way. You can't escape from it in a vacuum. You can't detach yourself from the world and not attach yourself to something else. Is the attachment, as I understand, is the attachment to the things of the kingdom, the truths of the kingdom, the beauty of the Baha'i teachings, the beauty of the revelation itself, which gradually takes the attention of our energies and our mind and transforms and purifies our thoughts. Know with true certainty, again the Master, that man was not created for the life of this world, as it is mortal, and there is no certainty therein. Is it possible that this great creation and glorious being should terminate in mortality? Is it meet that the result of God's creation, which is unlimited, that is, man, should live in this world a certain number of days with many difficulties, troubles, without repose and rest, and then die and end in mortality? No, verily, by truth, this is not meet. Nay, rather, this glorious being and grand creation was made for the eternal life, spiritual happiness, revelations of the heart, divine inspiration, heavenly perfections, and virtues of the kingdom. O thou divine servant, and here we begin the first of the quotations about what our attitude should be towards the loss of our loved ones when they pass away from us and we're left behind. O thou divine servant, be thou not unhappy on account of the death of thy father. All of us will hasten from this world. This mundane life has no importance whatsoever. It is our hope that in the divine worlds we shall find eternal union and souls, everlasting fellowship. Importance lies in this fact. This station is obtained through faith and self-sacrifice in the path of God. Consequently, we must make an effort to obtain happiness and joyousness in the other world. Now, I'm reading a lot of quotations. Do you have some comments or thoughts you'd like to mention? Or any questions or anything? Everyone's very subdued. I don't know. What will happen if I read some more? Is it all right? It takes a certain amount of these tablets to change our condition, I find myself, after the pushing of the day, even though one is doing spiritual things along with the other, but just to focus and center and draw away from the world. God has given man a heart, and the heart must have some attachment. We have proved that nothing is completely worthy of our heart's devotion save reality, for all else is destined to perish. Therefore, the heart is never at rest and never finds real joy and happiness until it attaches itself to the eternal. How foolish the bird that builds its nest in a tree that may perish, when it could build its nest in an ever verdant garden of paradise. Man must attach himself to an infinite reality so that his glory, his joy, and his progress may be infinite. Only the spirit is real. Everything else is as shadow. All bodies are disintegrated in the end. Only reality subsists. All physical perfections come to an end, but the divine virtues are infinite. How many kings have flourished in luxury, and in a brief moment all has disappeared. Their glory and their honor are forgotten. Where are the sovereigns now? But those who have been servants of the divine beauty are never forgotten. The result of their works is forever, is everywhere visible. What king is there of 2,000 years ago whose kingdom has lived in the hearts? But those disciples who were devoted to God, poor people who had neither fortune nor position, are today trees bearing fruit. Their banner is raised higher every day. Now, can you name many kings from the time of Christ was on the earth? But we can all name a few, at least, of the disciples and apostles of Christ. This is amazing, you know, Abdu'l-Bahá in the Will and Testament, and also in the Divine Plan, he mentions the apostles of Christ as examples for the Baha'is to follow. When you think that we recognize progressive revelation and all these various revelations and all the prophets have come and gone, he's fixed on the disciples and apostles of Christ. Of course, we're familiar in the West with those, but in the Will and Testament, he's addressing the Baha'is of all the world. There was something about the manner in which they arose and went off to different countries and died as martyrs and gave their whole being to the raising of the message of Jesus. That is the spirit that we need in this time to propagate the cause. Now think, what would you be thinking if you weren't thinking about what valley you're in? You know, your mind would be off doing something else. At least you're thinking about the valleys of the progress of the soul. You're wondering which one you're in and where you are in the scale. This inquiry is healthy. Now, what is we're trying to attach ourselves to reality, he says. What is reality? Reality is the revealed word of God as far as what we've got to hold on to here and the effects that that has in the soul. You know, being attached to the teachings, he talks about. Being attached to the divine verses. Being exhilarated every time you pick up the hidden words and you start reading them, you get intoxicated again. It's freeing and cleansing the human soul so that it's responsive to the gifts of these divine words. Anytime the soul approaches the verses or recites them or thinks about them, meditates, they release their blessings and energy into the soul's, the life of the soul. In that sense, it's like saying, you know, where is God? Well, it says you worship God with all your heart and all your mind and all your soul. And if you start thinking what God is and you have some picture of kind of far off, maybe very bright and big or something like that, you know, the Master says this is absolute imagination. you'd be better off worshipping a stick or a stone. At least that has some physical reality, whereas your imagination is totally unreal about what God is. So he warns us about not... And you know, you tend to fall into this. You're saying the prayers, oh God, my God, I don't know what we're addressing ourselves to. The Master says that in the center of such prayers should be the person of Baha'u'llah. We should address our prayers to him. There is a reality. That's the face of God that God has placed in the world. We should know is not God, so we don't worship him, but we worship through him. We worship through the light that comes from him, that we feel coming from him when we turn to it. And we try to see the increase of that abundance of light and of divine presence, of divine closeness. And by doing that, we move towards degrees closer towards the center of our existence, the source of reality, the sun of reality, as the writings call it. In reality, all the people are surrounded with sufferings, so that they may not attach their hearts to this world, but will seek for composure and rest in the divine world and beg for the bestowal of the kingdom. Now there the Master has explained why we have all this suffering in the world. Because if it wasn't a source of difficulties for us, if it wasn't a source of suffering, then surely we would attach ourselves to it. But the fact that when we attach ourselves to it, we find we don't get any satisfaction, or we don't get the satisfaction we think, you know. This is like, I know I was last week worrying about how good it felt to drive around in a new car. I was thinking how relative this is, you know. In a month or two, this is going to be so routine, you don't notice it at all. And how we puff ourselves up with little things like that and make ourselves happy. So easy to get yourself attached to anything. And how we do it, you know. Now, this is true happiness, Abdu'l-Bahá says, lies with spiritual things. The happiness of the world is very temporary. For instance, if you're hungry and you're served a wonderful, sumptuous dinner, really fragrant and delicious food, it's a source of joy and happiness. And if at the time you finish that dinner, you're served a second dinner, it's no longer a source of joy and happiness, then it starts to get to be a torture, you know? The same thing when you're exhausted and you want to go and rest, and you rest yourself, if when you want to get up because you're now refreshed, you're made to stay in bed another 24 hours or something. All of the joys of this world are that kind of temporary joys. That a little bit more than what you can stand, and they reverse their position. Suddenly they become, how nice it is to talk with a friend, some conversation. Yet if that conversation becomes prolonged, twice the length it needs to be, how it becomes oppressive. Well, maybe not for all of us, but for some. May defend who you're speaking with, but even that will gradually prove itself to be you know, the Bob says that prayer is the reality of prayer is this attraction that the heart feels, and that the prolongation, he says, of prayer is not pleasing to God. Once your soul is uplifted in prayer and you've prayed and so on, you're not going to go on praying, you know, because you say, well, I promised to say 19 tablets of Ahmad, and so I've got to do with them, and you're tired of saying them, and God's tired of hearing them. And Shoghi Effendi, in one of the World Order letters, The Unfoldment of World Civilization, in a paragraph, he sets the balance for the attitude that the Baha'is should have towards this life in general, this world. We'll remember this passage. Such a beautiful one. I'd like to read it again. Though willing to share to the utmost the temporal benefits and the fleeting joys which this earthly life can confer, though eager to participate in whatever activity that conduces to the richness, the happiness, and peace of that life, they can at no time forget that it constitutes no more than a transient, a very brief stage of their existence, that they who live it are but pilgrims and wayfarers whose goal is the celestial city and whose home the country of never failing joy and brightness. Now, the tablets that we've been reading about the Master, from the Master, are very strong. And we need that strong medicine at the beginning. But he says, as we become spiritually detached, if we don't let things become veils between us and God, then they're permitted to us, because all the good things of the world have been made for God's loved ones. But he says, nothing should come between you and the love of God. If you love things, or if you love somebody more than you love God, then that's a hindrance to your spiritual progress, and maybe a hindrance to their spiritual progress as well. O Son of Man, thou art my dominion, and my dominion perisheth not. Wherefore fearest thou thy perishing? Thou art my light, and my light shall never be extinguished. Why dost thou dread extinction? Thou art my glory, and my glory fadeth not. Thou art my robe, and my robe shall never be outworn. Abide then in thy love for me, that thou mayest find me in the realm of glory. And the most characteristic passage about death that we have in the hidden words, O Son of the Supreme, I have made death a messenger of joy to thee. Wherefore dost thou grieve? I made the light to shed on thee its splendor. Why dost thou veil thyself therefrom? Baha'u'llah says, in consolation to some of us that wonder why our loved ones and friends haven't seemed to show the signs of spiritual development before they pass from this world, he says, certain fruits, indeed, attain their fullest development only after being severed from the tree. Gleanings, page 155. And another tablet, also of Baha'u'llah, cited in the Gleanings, know thou that every hearing ear, if kept pure and undefiled, must at all times and from every direction hearken to the voice that uttereth these holy words. Verily, we are God's, and to him shall we return. Now, this is a phrase that's been incorporated in the Baha'i burial stone, inscription on the Baha'i burial stone. The phrase is very similar to this. It's ordained in the Actas to be placed on the finger of believers at the time that they're to be interred. Baha'u'llah goes on, he says, the mysteries of man's physical death and of his return have not been divulged and still remain unread. By the righteousness of God, were they to be revealed, they would evoke such fear and sorrow that some would perish, while others would be so filled with gladness as to wish for death and beseech with unceasing longing the one true God, exalted be his glory, to hasten their end. Death proffereth unto every confident believer the cup that is life indeed. It bestoweth joy and is the bearer of gladness. It conferreth the gift of everlasting life. And as to those that have tasted of the fruit of man's earthly existence, which is the recognition of the one true God, exalted be his glory, their life hereafter is such as we are unable to describe. The knowledge thereof is with God alone, the Lord of all worlds. And the master in table talks here in Akka, recorded in some answered questions, he says, to consider that after the death of the body, the spirit perishes, is like imagining that a bird in a cage will be destroyed if the cage is broken, though the bird has nothing to fear from the destruction of the cage. Our body is like the cage, and the spirit is like the bird. We see that without the cage, this bird flies in the world. In the world of sleep, it says here. Now, where's this now? You see that without this cage, this bird flies in the world of sleep. All right, this is the human condition now when we dream. Therefore, if the cage becomes broken, the bird will continue and exist. Its feelings will be even more powerful, its perceptions greater, and its happiness increased. In truth, from hell it reaches a paradise of delights, because for the thankful birds there is no paradise greater than freedom from the cage. Concerning the question of death, know thou that the spirit is abstract and sanctified from all things. It's a human spirit. For ingress and egress, ascent and descent, union and separation, are the properties of material beings and not of the spirit. Consequently, the human spirit does not enter in the physical body. Nay, rather, it has some attachment. This attachment is like unto the mirror and the sun. The sun does neither enter in nor exit from the surface of the mirror, nor absolutely identify with it, itself with it. But it, the sun, has some attachment with the mirror and reflects the self therein. However, when this attachment is interrupted, the mirror is deprived of illumination, beauty, and effulgence. A friend asked Abdu'l-Bahá, how should one look forward to death? And he answered, how does one look forward to the goal of any journey? With hope and with expectation. It is even so with the end of this earthly journey. In the next world, man will find himself freed from many of the disabilities under which he now suffers. Again asked about the connection that the spirit has with the body, Abdu'l-Bahá said, it has the same connection as the sun has with the mirror. Death is the name of this dissolution, of this connection. Again, he says, he was asked, what will become of the soul of man after death? He says, the body goes under the earth. Thence it came, and thither it goes. Everything that you see returns to its own plane. As the human body came from dust, to dust it returns. But the human spirit comes from God, and to him it returns. Baha'u'llah has revealed several tablets on life after death, the conditions in the other world. Some of the extracts from that are quoted in Gleanings also. We'll come to them eventually. The master said that all who read this tablet, or read it, are filled with an anxious desire to leave this world and enter the next condition. So wonderful are the glories of the spiritual kingdom. In Persia, one man who read this tablet killed himself. He could not wait for the happiness it promised him. Another, a youth of Isfahan, could not stand the spiritual food in this tablet and lost his reason. There was an occasion also in a story where someone begged Baha'u'llah to see the other world. And evidently they insisted enough till he finally, as was said, he raised his hands and he opened his fingers and said, what do you see? And the man looked between the fingers and he saw the other world. And he also went and took his life afterwards. And Baha'u'llah said, this is why we can't reveal anything of it. We can't show it. I mean, we have these stories. I don't know all the details, but they're told in different ways from time to time. You hear about people who take their lives if they see the other world. And you realize why it's in his wisdom to veil it from us in its full power. Now we know that suicide is not allowed and really is no solution to suffering. One has to detach oneself from the world, but not that way. Now, the master says in one tablet, one particularly strong tablet, which is good to know about because you may have to advise someone who has a tendency and thinks they're going to kill himself, or that you may fear it will get so depressed that they may try to do something like that. And this is the master saying that we didn't give ourselves life and we're not in a position to deprive ourselves or any soul of life. That there is no difference really from taking our life or taking the life of another. That suicide is tantamount to murder. And when you think of it in those terms, it sounds quite different from the choice of freedom I have of living or not living. You know, this is not one of the things it's given us to do. Now, I heard a very interesting story here. This question was asked of Shoghi Effendi. This is a pilgrim note, so remember it in those terms. He said, "Suicide is like arriving at a banquet uninvited." You know how you feel when you show up someplace and there's no place at the dinner table for you, you know. And, everyone's very loving, I'm sure. They try to go, "Well, surprise, you're here. I have to make a place for you when we're here." Or they'll tell you they're sorry there isn't enough food tonight and come back another time. I don't know what it's going to be. They just don't feed you for a while, maybe. But on the other hand, there are a number of letters and tablets to believers whose spouses or relatives have committed suicide for some reason, and saying the master says we'll pray for them and they will receive the bounty in the other world. And he also talks about that the favor of God encompasses every soul, but still one is going to suffer with the remorse of having disobeyed the law of God to some, you know. It's like all opportunities that are lost. Maybe he has something he wants you to do here. Maybe the suffering that you think you can't bear and is just the one that's needed so that your soul will be finally freed. Since he says all these... Sorry. Yes, well, that's another... Of course, God can judge that too. People who are completely beside themselves or who, like you say, want to relieve others of having to take care of them or something like that. But still, it's not given to us. And that very condition that we're in, that we think we don't want to burden anybody else with, maybe God is using that burden to develop that soul, somebody else's soul. The illness of old people is not just for them. I think it's for others that are around them as well. We can't see all the wisdoms in what happens. Fortunately, we have this whole way of growing old. God has created this pattern of being born young and growing old. And as we grow older, the people of our generation begin slipping away around us, our friends. We see the impermanence of it. Not to mention that our hair is falling out and our teeth are falling out and we've got signs that we're not going to last forever. And we begin thinking in terms of, well, what is the truth? You know, where are we going to end up? Somebody else have something? Please. Capital punishment. In the Baha'i teachings, capital punishment is sanctioned. In fact, all the prophets of God have given capital punishment in one form or another that we know of in the revealed books that we have. And Baha'u'llah sanctions it also in certain instances. But he says it will depend on the degree of the actions of the people involved, whether it would be capital punishment or life imprisonment for murder, for example. But he allows for it. And Abdu'l-Bahá says that the criminal will be punished for the crime, will suffer the consequences. And he says that if the murderer takes the punishment of God in this world, then he has not that punishment to face in the next world. So by giving his life here, he's paid his dues and arrives in the next world without that burden. Whereas if he escapes and hides and dies, then he'll have to face the punishment independent of that. So, you know, you wonder what's better. I mean, when you look at it in the long run, there are some mercies. Now, we don't have to advertise about capital punishment right now. It's like, you know, saying, the first thing you say in the Baha'i meeting is, you know, the Baha'i faith, we don't drink beer. And everybody says, oh, well, what a wonderful religion. You know, what else do you don't do? But we should know that so that we're not too outspoken about, you know, against capital punishment in society, because we really don't have a basis for assuming that position. When the Actas is published, the details of that will be there as well with notes, because it's in the Actas. Yes, that's true. But it still has to do with taking another's life intentionally. I mean, this is the crime, and it's a crime now. And of course, this self-defense is allowed. I mean, there's manslaughter, which is different from murder. Well, that's also there to be considered.
I think that when somebody dies, my understanding is that the soul hangs around this world for a while and then it just moves off. Is that true? And is it the same for the manifestations of God? Because they tend to exert the influence and then after a while.
Let's divide that into two parts. Let's forget about the second part. We'll come back to that after. The first part, as far as I know, the soul doesn't remain attached to this world because it's not physically located. Spirit is something different from body. It may focus its attention, but it's always where it always is in that sense. You know, it's a question of what it's viewing, what it's seeing, and. There's no support about this, that, you know, don't bury the body or don't do anything, don't burn the body. But there were some ideas that the early believers thought that it takes 3 days for the soul to detach itself thoroughly from the body, and so you wouldn't want to burn it, and that's why we don't burn. But there's none of that. Both the Master and Shoghi Effendi in his letters have said we don't have any such teaching. That the soul, at the moment of death, it begins to move towards its creator, you know. You remember the passages in the Igan where it talks about.
It seems that for a period of years, the soul is in contact with the people in this world more, and then it's just the contact with them.
No, as far as what we see, they're taken up into the society of the spiritual realms right away, and they would be. Who knows, they will be taught and illumined or whatever is necessary there. But they will have knowledge and memory and access to their loved ones here. But that's not going to fade away after a few years, as long as they have loved ones here. Now, okay, so we're in eternity for a long time. Now, maybe we have loved ones, and by the time 60, 70 years pass in this world, all those loved ones are on the other side. So maybe then the attention, like you say, would be less connected, unless we were part of the certain hosts that were out helping the teachers or something. I don't know how that part works. Please.
Well,
Yes.
That's one reason. So does that actually keep them in?
I think it's a question of letting loose of their attention more than keeping them, because it's not a question of space the way we think of it. I mean, we interpret it in terms of, you know, holding them to us, but... We have some evidence to that. We'll have some tablets that we'll read, one in particular that speaks about the hindering that excessive grief produces on loved ones. Now, as far as I know, spiritual souls, when they pass away, exert a much greater influence on the world after death than while they're still in their earthly existence. And the special example of that is the manifestation of God, who is veiled to some degree, the splendors of his reality are veiled to some degree by an earthly temple. Although, for the eyes that are keen, they still see that presence there. But Shoghi Effendi says in the beginning of the chapter where he describes the passing of Baha'u'llah, that he says, now freed from the encumbrances, of, so to speak, of a human body, the full splendor and glory of his reality is shed upon humanity. That light, far from lessening, will increase day by day as more souls reflect that light. So the more Baha'is there are in the world, the greater the presence of Baha'u'llah will become in this world, because they will be the mirrors of his luminous reality. And he is a light that's, as we know, is destined to overshadow everything for 500,000 years. So I don't think we can say that the manifestation in that sense fades out. But also the light that he is the recipient and reflector of is the same light that the other manifestations have. And they remain luminous in the heavenly realms too. So we don't know what their assignment is, you know, so to speak. What they will be occupied with. Right? Yeah? Yes.
Have you read anything about how the revelation of Baha'u'llah is revealed in this world? In this world, we have it in the written form. And one of my small little fears is that when I look at all those things, I couldn't memorize. And although we have the great beings in the next world, how will those
Well, you see, you know what he even has recited. He says, now this is written on the fourth chrysolite tablet or something of the most exalted paradise. So I think there's plenty of the word of the mother book and everything is all preserved. I don't think you have to worry about it, although you maybe in your initial travels you'd like to have some divine verses with you. But you'll have the greatest name. And the point is that one should become familiar with the principles operating in the teachings. You know? That is appreciation of those. It's like learning to look at art, you know, something like that, or nature, or the knowledge that a biologist has of when he looks at a patch of garden, or a botanist, compared to the average person looking at it and saying, "Oh, isn't that nice?" You know, but not seeing so many things that are there. Whereas attention and intense study of the divine teachings, the level of your appreciation and perceptions will expand tremendously. And under the course, having the veils of this life removed, how much clearer you'll see things. So there's that, and it's worth studying for. That's the only study that we really carry into the other world. Please.
Thank you.
cremate bodies. Abdu'l-Bahá, we'll come to something about that too. Abdu'l-Bahá speaks about it. He said it's not according to nature. In fact, he says that if it were part of the scheme of nature, that the body would itself ignite at death. You know, if that's what it was to do. But if left to itself, it doesn't do that. And that it's too sudden a change from the human kingdom, the atoms and molecules that are related to the human temple that have been the vehicle for the expression of the human spirit in this life, in this world, are too radically changed in the process of burning that they should return to the earth over long periods of time and be part of creation. So he tells us it's forbidden in the book. So it's a Baha'i law, actually, not to cremate. Yes. They do that with cemeteries all the time now, but they don't wait 300 years. They do it in 20 or 30. I haven't seen anything written on the subject. I suppose the House of Justice will have to address that with regard to Baha'is. Don't know. With skyscrapers, yeah, there'd have to be change of Baha'i law for burial beneath the ground, you know, that we have. But the House has said it's all right to have multiple niches within a grave. I don't know how they're going to handle it. There are two things. One is that I've heard Dr. Roo talk about this too. He says it's known that the people have constraints, you know, their customs, their manners. They know how to act so that other people will like their presence and so on, and they do that when they're alert. But as they become more and more senile, the soul tends to be expressive of what its own reality really is, in other words, what it really loves. And sometimes you see the consequence of people that are very selfish and very angry, really, but have hidden that quite well. But as they become older, they become angry, you know. So Aunt Minnie starts cussing all the time and embarrassing the family, you know. That dear old Baha'i lady that I know that used to wrap the books at the local assembly, I went to visit her in the rest home and she was telling me the most horrendous things. I didn't know what was the matter with her. But on the other hand, sometimes it happens from physical limitations of another sort or from medication indeed. I know I had a very sweet mother-in-law who became very difficult for several long years. And one thought here, this is a woman who had given 25 years pioneering. She was still in the pioneer field, and the injured and wounded were coming away from her on all times. She was really just cutting everybody down and in such a bad condition. Till finally she had to leave her pioneer post and go to a rest home in the United States, and the rest homes didn't want her. And finally a Baha'i doctor started helping to try to calm her down and make her a little more polite so that she could. This was really, these are events that happen in people's lives, very difficult things. And he found that the dosage of medicine that she'd been on for 10 years for epileptic fits, that because of a plane crash during Baha'i travels, she had a tendency in late life, due to injury, to have epileptic seizures. It was too strong a dose. And he found another medicine, adjusted that, brought it down, made it a smaller thing. The next time we saw Juanita, she was her old loving self. And weeping that we'd come to see her and that we'd send her something, and it's just like that ever since. Teaching the faith with such love in the home where she is, and it's amazing, you know, what sometimes chemical changes in the body can produce. So I don't know, there's no firm answer on that, you know, we don't know. But sometimes perhaps a good physician would be able to find a solution for that problem. One can hope. Well, you'd have to read the full tablet of the Master on the subject. You know, matter is built up. First, it is in the mineral stage, and then it gradually becomes part of the plant kingdom. The mineral kingdoms, in other words, are influenced by the vegetable spirit and take on the characteristics of the vegetable spirit and become vegetable life or plant life. And then that gradually gives force, develops to a stage where the animal kingdoms and its potentialities begin to appear in the world. So these atoms that were first minerals have been coursing through these various stages in and out of plant life and animal life and so on, and finally their highest attainment is in the human, being part of the human kingdom, that is in the human temple. The temple which is a vehicle of the human spirit. And that in itself, Abdu'l Baha says, we should respect and honor the body. That's one aspect of it. The other is that burning sends those molecules and the physical substance of the body back to the mineral stage directly, turns it to ash, whereas it should go back through the animal kingdom and it becomes incorporated in the plant life again and so on. It's not a radical change of that sort. This is, at least that's what I've understood from what I've read of it. There's this various, the balance, the ecology of how these atoms course through all of these various kingdoms. No, it's not at all harmful to the soul. It doesn't have anything to do with the soul, no. It's just a question of the balance of matter in this world. This is why he talks about it. Yes, well, I don't know if it ends with those lines, but I remember a tablet like that. There's several on this subject.
I found that very beautiful and like a very nice end for the body that was associated with the soul.
Yes. And how many, you know, what would it take for that to again start from the condition of ash to come to that stage? I don't know how all that works, but something to think about. Yes, Joe? Yes.
Like in the United States, you know, first it's put into this casket, and the casket is put into a metal thing, and the metal thing is put into a concrete thing. I mean, there's no way that body is ever going to get back to the earth. You know what?
Not soon, anyway. It seems clear, yes. Well, even the faith prescribes, you know, hard wood or crystal coffins. And so this again, this question of preserving the body for a time seems to have its meaning also, because again, that particular set of atoms and molecules has been the vehicle of the human spirit. But surely it will become dust.
So eventually it becomes dust, maybe it's at that point that people dump it all into the earth.
I don't know. Someone will loot your tomb or something. Maybe the moon will become closer than 1 hour's travel. I don't know.
Are there any laws about throwing the body in the ocean?
No.
Is that okay?
That's possible.
After death.
After death, yes. burial at sea. If you can't reach the hour's distance, you're free to bury at sea, yes. Some souls have had forced burial at sea. You know, Dorothy Baker died in an air crash in the Mediterranean. Shoghi Effendi mentioned afterwards that she had said, oh, how she'd love to be buried in the Holy Land. And he said that her grave reaches under the shores of the Holy Land. It's the whole Mediterranean is her grave. And he erected himself an obelisk in Rome in her memory. In a cemetery. So that's indicative of a possibility. If we lost a loved one at sea, we could put up a monument someplace or a marker somewhere in remembrance of him.
Is there anything that says, like, if somebody has been cremated, about what you can do in the ashes?
Doesn't arise because it says don't cremate, so. Guess
like
you'd be free, yeah, somebody else.
Not
yes, you know, yes. Yeah. And wants to be cremated, and it is cremated, and then you get the ashes, and you want to know what they do. I think you're free to do what you want with them.
There's
in accordance with
civil
law or however. I think as a Baha'i, we would bury them, but I've seen some advice. I think I've seen advice of that. But anyway.
Since truth in all religion is the same. What are we doing there with Hinduism? What is a custom? Or is it actually a law, but is it just a custom? People in this area that they burn the bodies?
Mm-hmm. Well, we know that we don't have the laws really of Hinduism and Buddhism in a clear form. We have admonitions and councils, but as far as we know, they've been written by the priestly castes, sometime after. Certain elements we do, but not laws, so to speak, to that degree. So we have to trust that if that's the law of God, that perhaps they've gotten off course with what they've been doing. You know? We'll have to wait and see. Mm-hmm. Yes? Please? Good.
Maybe looking up more toward the sky than the stars. When you die, the body is free to roam all around the universe's places. But also in the writings is that each planet has its creatures and the mysteries, and the mysteries of which only God can. There's a inconsistency I see. Can the human souls also search the mysteries of the universe because they are free? So is it limited? Are they limited in the limit?
Yes, it's not my impression that the soul goes, searching around the material universe afterwards. Observing things, because there's a spiritual universe which is the counterpart. This outward universe is the material counterpart of something spiritual. And in that spiritual realm, we will have access, of course, as permitted by God, to infinite worlds and conditions and states. Whether they'll be like planets like we know in this outer world, we don't know how it will be. So that's one thing. The other thing is that I think that the thing that's unknown about these worlds, every planet hath its creatures, and every sun hath its planets, and every planet hath its creatures, whose number no man can compute, that the mystery of it is the infinity of it. Maybe there are conditions also, but we'd have to look at the tablet to see exactly what it says and see how it would apply. If there's not room enough to be buried in this world, in this earth, there probably won't be much room to live in it either, so maybe by that time we will be colonizing other areas. Who knows how that will work, you know, if overpopulation becomes a burden. We seem destined to create certain conditions to limit population with our present activities and the way we're poisoning the Earth's atmosphere and stuff. The what?
The Bible.
Yes. Two-thirds will be laid low. Yeah, Shri Vipani refers to that in Pilgrim Notes and also says that it's the same thing as in Quranic traditions. But I haven't seen what it is in Quranic traditions, what it refers to. The possibility of a large portion of the population of the earth passing away. Baha'u'llah says that were we to have the proper vision to see the blessings of the other world, we would not bear to endure one more hour of existence upon the earth. The reason we are deprived of that vision is because otherwise no one would care to remain and the whole fabric of society would be destroyed. It's a letter of Shoghi Effendi. I think with that note we'll leave this for next week. Which centers in more again on this attitude towards the loss of loved ones in more detail.